Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why different kinds of sunscreens may be on store shelves in the U.S. in the future, and creating art out of pink erasers. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
Our standing is that I'm representing the people of Arizona, who are now down one representative, and more specifically, I'm representing the 813,000 people in CD7 who are now being taxed without representation.
Yet another Democrat politician from Arizona is trying to get national publicity, so now it's the state AG who's going to sue me because Grijalva is not yet sworn in.
If we cave on this, it's going to be a very difficult 3 years going forward. Every time we try and fund the government, the Democrats will come in and say, we want X, Y, and Z, and if you don't give it to us, we're going to shut down the government.
Trying to do both does not serve the purposes of either her role as chair or her role as a candidate running for a very competitive district, both in a primary and a general election.
I would like my national organization to help further the interests of governors, and it's been challenging to be on the same page in these really partisan times, and I'm not sure that that's what's happening right now.
And with me to talk about a lawsuit trying to force a congressional swearing-in, a couple of new entrants into congressional races, and more are Paul Bentz of High Ground. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
And Democratic strategist Tony Connie. Tony, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Tony, let me start with you. AG Chris Mays threatened to sue House Speaker Mike Johnson for not swearing in Adelita Grijalva, the representative-elect. Now she has done it. Grijalva is a party to that suit as well. Does this speed things up at all, do you think?
I don't know if it's going to speed things up, but it's a way to be like, hey, look, this is real. I know this is like a game that you're playing in Washington, D.C., but this is having a real impact on the people of Arizona. And so, you know, the attorney general – you know, when she threatened to sue, it was a hope that maybe that would be something that would push, the speaker to actually, you know, do the ceremony to like, you know, to make, take the elect out of Congresswoman-elect Grijalva's title. But, you know, I really wish, you know, he's used so many different excuses about the reason why he's not doing this. And of course, most people are saying that it's because of the Epstein files and all that kind of stuff. You know, he's not negotiating with Democrats right now. I don't know what he's doing. I wish he's got plenty of time. I wish he would just do this. He's also being asked a lot of questions about this. If he just did this swearing in, like, this would stop being an issue. And so it is really frustrating. You know, just do it. Give the voters in that district representation so that they have an office that they can call, like all those regular things. And, you know, it's pretty frustrating.
Well,
from my perspective.
One of the interesting things is there seems to be some debate about what Representative-elect Grijalva can actually do. She's saying, you know, I don't have an email. I don't have access to databases. I finally got keys to the office, but like I'm not really sure. I can't hire staff. And Speaker Johnson's like, you should be doing all that stuff anyway. Don't make TikTok videos. Help your constituents. She's saying, I can't.
Well, why? She's following the rules here, and if he's saying she should do it and she should do all the things that a congresswoman would do, why wouldn't they just swear her in?
Yeah.
I mean, this is why people are fed up with Washington. This is when we talk about the swamp that we're allegedly supposedly draining. You've got the Republican saying that they don't want to swear this individual in, and it's this whole notion that you can't give an inch on anything. So you've got larger negotiations going on. You've got the budget bills. You've got the shutdown, and it leaks all the way down to a swearing in of a rightly elected person who wants to get in and do their job. It's just – this is why people are fed up with Washington. This is why people are fed up. And you know, there's people cheering, I'm sure, because of the hyper-partisan nature of the way things go. But this only makes things worse. It doesn't make anything better.
I wonder, Tony, if looking at this sort of in a cynical political lens, in some way, does this maybe help Representative-elect Grijalva? In if nothing else, I mean, she's kind of a household name now, whereas maybe if she had just been elected in a special election in Tucson to succeed her father, maybe people across the country wouldn't know who she was.
Yeah, I mean, the least senior, the most junior member of the entire Congress is now getting probably the most media attention that's positive of any of them. And so from that perspective, it's true. But, but she doesn't care about that. You know, she's even said, look, I would like to just have a meeting with the speaker so we can talk this out. Like she really legitimately just wants to get to work.
So, Paul, like how does this end? What's the end game here? I mean, is it really like the government has to reopen before she gets sworn in? And if that goes on, like, for months, I mean, they're not really negotiating, so who knows how long the shutdown will last. Could she be in this limbo for some really long period of time?
Certainly, and I think that sort of the turnabout is fair play. It sort of reminds me of the filibuster discussion. You know, people want to get rid of it when it's something that they want, and then they want to keep it when they're trying to fight against something they get. The slow playing of appointments in this case, you know, certainly then there's a precedent for it if the Democrats come into control and maybe they follow the same rules. People don't think long term about the impact of what they're doing. People don't think of the impact of how it's going to play out when they are maybe not in charge or maybe, you know, the next time they need something done. And in fact, I think swearing her in would be a sign of goodwill towards the Democrats to try to maybe get them to the negotiating table or get them to maybe at least have a discussion. But no, it's like everything right now. Every little bit, just anytime you can twist the knife, you know, they're just seeming to try to find a way to do it at this point.
And yet there are still people who want to serve in Congress. We saw this week, Paul, two Republicans getting into races. Let's start with CD1. That is the seat that Congressman David Schweikert is leaving to run for governor. Gina Swoboda, she'd been rumored to be jumping into this race. She made it official this week. She, of course, is the chair of the state Republican Party. But she's also not seemingly universally beloved by all members of the party.
Right. I mean, so CD1's one of our very competitive districts. It's going to be a tough race. Two cycles ago, Schweikert only won it by about 2,000 votes. In the presidential cycle, he actually won it by about three times as much. But every race, it's a very competitive district. It was one of the things that Democrats really focused on when they did redistricting is they gave up some power in some other districts and made them even redder to make this one a little bit more competitive long term. I had said at the time that by the end of the decade, it would be a Democratic seat. That was the goal. I'm not sure in this cycle, the way things are right now with registration and whatnot, if that's going to happen. But no, she's not only – she did get Trump's endorsement, so I think that's huge for her in the primary and certainly makes her the front runner. But she's also spoken out on things like ESAs and others that are actually pretty reasonable approaches to things, and that doesn't necessarily make her popular with some of the base.
Is she somebody who clears the field for Republicans?
I don't think any of these open seats are going to have a clear field. I think in this environment right now, we didn't get the 10th congressional district following the census. So there is this increased desire. We didn't – I always say we talked about rearranging the deck chairs. The 10th district would have done that. You know, we don't have that. So between the CD1 spot open and the CD5 open, I think we're going to see a lot of Republicans jump in to try to jockey for position because it's as close to an open spot as you're going to get.
Yeah. So, Tony, if you are any of the number of Democrats running in CD1, you see Gina Swoboda jump in, what is going through your mind?
Well, I think they probably are thinking about the fact that the Trump endorsement is something that is powerful in making it so she might get through that primary. Of course, he has endorsed multiple people in competitive races recently, so maybe he will do that again. And so either way, though, you're looking at the fact that, okay, they're going to have now a messy primary the way that potentially we are going to have a competitive primary. And so there's a hope that, you know, that they're going to tear each other down on the Republican side enough and try to go farther and farther and farther right the way that you see is happening in the governor's race in order to appeal to President Trump in a district where that really won't be helpful at all. And so from that regard, it's like, OK, good. Why don't you guys have this little Trump fight over there on the side, especially when, you know, his popularity is so bad, especially on the economy right now. And we're going to just focus on trying to, you know, run a good campaign so that you can get someone to represent you who cares about you and not President Trump only.
Tony, do you think that the Democratic field in that race is set at this point?
I don't. I think so, but anybody could jump in at any time. We're seeing that. And one thing that I think you saw from the last cycle is that when there is this sort of really large field, kind of anybody can win.
Mm-hmm. You don't need a huge majority to win.
Yeah, and I think especially right now where, you know, where Democrats are really like looking for leadership and looking for people who are willing to fight, I think that people might be open to other candidates. And so one of the things when it comes to this is like, is there somebody who's courageous enough to decide to jump in now instead of waiting for another opportunity? And if somebody's been thinking like, I want to run for Congress, like this is a good opportunity. And so, I haven't heard anything, but I would not be surprised if somebody else jumped in.
Okay. I think people from both sides are thinking about it. There's a lot of, thinking, calling, looking around. You know, I get calls from people. What do you think? When it's an open seat, especially in that sort of area where there's a lot of wealth, where there's been a longtime congressman so that it hasn't been competitive more recently, mm-hmm. I think people look at that as an opportunity. I see why Democrats would think it's a good opportunity. I don't know if this is the right cycle for that. Midterms generally benefit Republicans. But that said, it's as open as it's going to be. So I think a lot of people are going to seriously consider it.
Well, so Paul, you'd mentioned how Swoboda has the Trump endorsement. And Tony pointed out correctly that President Trump does have a habit at times of endorsing multiple candidates in the same race. We see it in the governor's GOP primary. I wonder, though, in that district, how much weight does a Trump endorsement carry, maybe relative to some of the other districts in this state?
In the primary, quite a bit still. I mean, it's a big chunk of Scottsdale. It's very, very conservative leaning. We see the Scottsdale mayor won on a pretty conservative platform. I think it really helps in the primary. In the general election, it's going to be more difficult. CD1's also home to several of our swing legislative districts. It's well exercised. A lot of ground game in those areas, a lot of very attentive people on both sides, and a proven list of sort of crossover Republicans and independents who have willing to pick and choose. But Swoboda is a little bit different in that she's not quite – this is not the MAGA candidate. I mean, they're going to paint her as that, but she doesn't have that same MAGA credential despite being very successful for Trump and others.
It's interesting because for a long time, David Schweiker, rightly or wrongly, was sort of seen as tiptoeing this line between MAGA and not. And here you're kind of describing Gina Swoboda the same way. She has the Trump endorsement, but has also kind of ticked off some of the MAGA voters.
Right. And, I think there certainly will be another candidate that tries to harness that at a minimum. They typically can't help themselves. There'll probably be more than one of those types that jump in together and fight against one another. We've seen that in multiple races in that general area. So I expect that to be the same this time around as well. Swoboda being not only Trump endorsed, and you're right, and look at the Masters versus Hamadeh race and others. There's been multiple endorsements. Certainly a chance of that, mm-hmm. but her getting it early I think will really help her in this case.
All right. That is Paul Bentz. I'm also joined by Tony Conne. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guests this week are Democratic strategist Tony Conne and Paul Bentz of High Ground. Tony, we were talking about CD1 just a moment ago. Let's talk about the 5th Congressional District. This is the district in the Southeast Valley that Congressman Andy Biggs is leaving to also run for governor. And there are already a number of pretty well-known candidates in that race, not least among them former Cardinals kicker Jay Feely, Travis Grantham, a state representative. But this week, a former Pinal County Sheriff Mark Lamb said that he was also jumping into that race. He, of course, ran against Kerry Lake in the Senate race last time and did not make it out of the primary. But the conventional wisdom is that he sort of becomes the front runner, maybe based on name ID, at least at this point. Do you buy into that?
Yeah, I think I do. I was surprised that he announced the run only because I've done some radio programs with him over the time, and I've chatted with him about this. And he was reluctant. He basically said, like, I have an opportunity to sort of live a regular life with my wife and do all these kinds of things. But he did say that Senator Hoffman had been recruiting him.
Hmm. And Jake Hoffman, the chair of the Freedom Caucus, for a long time.
And so it looks like, finally that message went through. But, I'm sure they were doing polling and there must have been a shift or perhaps he just, got a little more confident there is a reason to do this. I don't think he would jump in and run if he thought that it wasn't going to be a pretty clear race. That's just my sort of read of things. And so, you know, I was very surprised. But, you know, we'll see. I think the bigger question up there is going to be about fundraising. And, you know, you've got Grantham, who legislators tend to not have a great Republican legislators, when they run for Congress, aren't great at raising money. It's a thing. It's a challenge to learn to raise the amount of money you need for a congressional race. And so, you know, I imagine that that the sheriff will have a much higher profile and be able to raise a lot more money. And then, you know, it's just going to be a MAGA off up there to see sort of who can, you know, try and get the president's endorsement.
Well, that's again a really, really safe Republican district. I mean, do you think his Senate run helps him in terms of name ID and fundraising?
Yeah, he's also just – I mean, he had like a reality TV show, right? Like, I mean, this is a very like public, guy. And so, you know, very charismatic. And so I do think I think that he's a really strong candidate.
Paul, do you see him as the front runner having jumped in now?
Well, us in the great state of Maricopa always sort of think of this as the Southeast Valley district. It contains a pretty decent portion of Pinal County, including Apache Junction, Gold Canyon, and the Santan Valley area. Santan Valley recently incorporated and overnight became the largest city in Pinal County. The sheriff is incredibly popular, one of the most popular individuals in Pinal County. He was all the way through and still remains very popular in Pinal County. So I think he's counting on that as part of that popularity. So not only is it just sort of this MAGA reality personality ability to raise money after a Senate race, name ID is probably better. He's also really popular in Pinal County. So I think those things help him a lot and make it a much more competitive race for him. Gone are the days where we just think of that as it's the Gilbert, you know, sort of the East Valley piece. It's actually a much broader Pinal County piece. And Pinal is one of the places that is getting more conservative over time.
This to me is such an interesting race because for many reasons, but also, you know, you have sort of the outsider candidate in someone like Jay Feely. We talk about name ID. He clearly has name ID. He's clearly, I would think, a pretty popular person. I mean, he was a successful NFL player for many years, including with the hometown team here. How does that sort of factor into somebody who's been in elected office is popular? Somebody who's not been in elected office is also popular.
Well, they both wear uniforms, right? you've got Feely in a Cardinals uniform and you've got the sheriff in a sheriff's uniform. In that case, in a Republican primary, I think of the two, probably the sheriff's uniform and the badge do a little better.
You think that's more popular than a kicker's uniform?
Yeah, I think if he wore the one bar.
The single bar.
Like in the old days.
The old Sean Landetta bar there.
Now, I haven't seen Feely speak much, but, you know, he did television after his time in the NFL. He's pretty well spoken. I would suspect that will help. So is the sheriff. So I think it will be interesting because you've got several well-spoken candidates. So it'll come down to sort of organizing and money in that race.
Tony, let me ask you about a newish, I guess, party, or at least a newly named political party in Arizona. The No Labels Party is now the Arizona Independent Party. And I kind of wonder if for some voters this might prove confusing, who consider themselves independents and maybe confuse like not being registered with a party with being registered with the Arizona Independent Party.
Well, I mean, that stuff like that has happened before where depending on what people write down, you know, they might write down independent and they're listed sort of differently on the file or whatever. But I think maybe when it comes down to it, I think that this kind of a name change in the long run doesn't really matter. I think that I'm not saying they did this because they thought that this is a way they could trick voters. I'm not saying that.
Sure.
But anyone who thinks that, I think it's just not giving voters enough credit. It's really a challenge to win as a third party candidate or to pull people away if the candidate doesn't have a high profile. And so, you know, I'm not too like worried about this. It's a little bit annoying to me in some ways, the idea that this is going to, you know, that this is what voters are looking for. I don't think that's what we're seeing, you know, that voters are looking for some sort of like, you know, middle party. I think people are looking for sort of boldness and a clear vision and are looking for people who will get things done. And they're sometimes willing to look past ideology in order to do that. I think we're seeing that happening now. And so, you know, I'm not sure how much of a role this is going to have in anything. But yeah, they decided to change their name.
Well, so, Paul, obviously we have no idea who is going to run on this party platform, if anybody.
Right.
But I'm wondering, assuming that they get some candidates in some races, What kind of role does that play in voter behavior and in the results?
Well, first of all, it messes up my narrative. I always like to say there's not an independent party in the state of Arizona. Most folks are unaffiliated, and there's a smaller portion that consider themselves independent, small I. So now there's an independent party. It's a little bit of a hack. So if you wanted to run unaffiliated in the state, you go straight to the general election, but you have you got to collect six times as many signatures as any other candidate. So now this gives people an opportunity to get on a ballot as a quote unquote independent for a much, much smaller qualification. And I think that's going to be attractive to a lot of candidates. So I think we'll see more third party candidates. And the last time around, we only had one or two in all of the legislature. I think we might see more in the future. And I think it will at least create some dialogue where independent voters will not be able to be ignored until the general election, because if you want to build that coalition of folks, you're going to want to get to them early. So that'll be interesting. They're a very small group right now still, but I do see a chance for them to grow that number, A, and B, probably field some competitive candidates. Maybe that they don't necessarily win, but they definitely will change the dialogue.
So, Tony, I mean, do you think this is maybe more of a long game as opposed to a 2026 issue, maybe a 2028, 2030 kind of thing where this party might have some real impact on elections?
Well, I'm still waiting for the Reform Party to have the impact that they thought they would have when they announced. I just don't the way that we elect, you know, I think maybe this will have an impact in like city races or some of these other types of races. The way that we elect people is the reason why there's a two-party system. It's the fact that it's a, you know, first past the post, two people, that's what it is. Like, that, you know, political science say that the method of our election is the reason why there's two parties. And so unless the method of our elections change, I don't think that this party is going to grow.
All right. Interesting. So, guys, we got about 30 seconds left. So I'm going to spring something on you. World Series starts tonight. Who you got? Dodgers, Blue Jays, Paul?
Not the Dodgers. But
you don't care who it is as long as it's not the Dodgers.
But I do want to say this is the last weekend to mail in your ballot. The November 4th election
what
is coming
pivot.
Up. And you need to make sure to mail your ballot this weekend. Otherwise, you need to bring it to a Dropbox location.
So maybe fill it out while you're watching the World Series.
Exactly.
And then you can mail it in. So who do you got?
I've got Phoenix Suns tonight. I'm going to be watching the Suns.
You know they're
not
playing
the
World
Dodgers.
Series, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, they're not. Yeah.
That is the biggest dodge I've.
I'll give you a big prediction. They'll win more games than they lose this year.
The Suns
will. Yeah.
Wow.
That is
a hot take.
There we go.
According to a lot of the NBA prognosticators. All right, Tony, Connie, Paul, Benz. Thanks to you both. I really appreciate it. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, creating art on an item typically used to erase mistakes. But first, a bipartisan effort in the U.S. House and Senate would increase the number and kinds of sunscreens available to buy in this country. Generally speaking, the U.S. has stricter rules than do other countries about the ingredients that are allowed to be used in over-the-counter sunscreens and the kinds of testing needing to be done on them before they're allowed to be sold here. The proposed measure would streamline those issues. Supporters say it would allow Americans to take advantage of advancements in sunscreens from other parts of the world. Critics, though, worry about whether those new sunscreens are safe to use. With me to talk more about this is Dr. Josh Ternus, a board-certified dermatologist with Banner Health. And Dr. Ternus, what do you make of these efforts to allow the kinds of sunscreens that are sold in other parts of the world to also be sold here?
I think it's great. I think that, you know, it's come back up in the news. The FDA has tried to, at times, to amend the OTC monograph for sunscreens, and there was something in the CARES Act where they were trying to make some modifications to it. But we really haven't approved a new sunscreen ingredient for over 20 or 25 years. And so we are falling a little bit behind the times. Europe has a lot more sunscreen ingredients approved than we do. Most of them are in the chemical sunscreen category. You know, broadly, we lump sunscreens into two different categories: chemical sunscreens, which are more absorbers of the UV light, as opposed to your mineral or physical sunscreens, which tend to be reflectors of the UV light. I think that opening up the possibility for responsible, safe approvals of more ingredients and making that a little bit easier and kind of leveling the playing field from our partners in other developed countries, I think is only a benefit to patients, because I think, you know, I tell people, you know, the best sunscreen is the one you're going to use. So having more choices and more things that people's skin can tolerate is a net benefit for preventing sun damage, and especially what I specialize in, skin cancer.
Well, for people who are inclined to use sunscreen anyway, regardless of, you know, where they can get it or what kind it is, I'm wondering if you think, if, for example, we were able to get and use the kinds of sunscreens, for example, they have in Europe, would that make things better for us here? Like, would that reduce the incidence, for example, of skin cancer in a sunny place like Phoenix?
Absolutely. I think that if you have a wider range of ingredients that are going to be tolerable to patients or people, I call them patients because I'm a physician, but to people that use them, the more choices we have, the more cosmetically elegant and lighter feeling ingredients that we can have, that people who are hesitant to use sunscreens that might be a little thicker, a little creamier, maybe people that have acne prone skin, things of that nature. I think the more choices we have and the better filters we have available, the more likely we are to see people use them and use them regularly. And that, in my mind, is going to turn into a decrease of the incidence of skin cancer.
Is it safe to say that it's not unheard of that you would have to have a conversation with a patient about how that patient like should be wearing sunscreen?
Absolutely. It's a daily occurrence in my practice of skin cancer surgery. We, especially if it's somebody I'm seeing for the first time with their first skin cancer, we talk about prevention and, you know, good sunscreen use, because that can certainly lower your risk over time. You know, it definitely, I think it's important to say that, you know, sun damage is something that builds over years. It's not just one sunburn you got. It's not just when you're a kid. It's not just when you're at the beach. So being good with it and using it steadily over time is really going to be a net benefit to you.
Yeah. Well, so what reasons do people give you for not wearing sunscreen?
It's too much work to reapply. It's greasy. I don't like it. It messes with my golf grip. I'm just outside for 30 minutes. You know, it's all of those things. I spend most of my time in the car. You know, all of these things are things that we hear. You know, I think it's important that, you know, we cover, especially living in a place like Arizona, you cover the exposed skin when you leave the house. You know, the windows of your car don't do a great job of blocking cancer causing you ultraviolet A rays. They do a really decent job of blocking ultraviolet B rays. It's probably not a perfect analogy, but I call kind of A, UVA, your aging and cancer causing rays, and B, your burning rays that give you a sunburn. They both matter for both things, but you're not going to get a sunburn behind the windows of your car, but you are getting cancer causing rays. And so sunscreen, you know, when you're on your daily commute, is something that I recommend to people. You know, and also tinting your windows is a great other measure, especially here.
Well, so you kind of alluded to this, but I wonder if, you know, if you were able to talk to your patients about different kinds of sunscreen, or maybe, you know, ones that are, up until whatever time you're having this conversation, had only been available in other places. Do you think that would make your job easier in terms of trying to convince your patients who don't want to wear sunscreen that they should?
Absolutely. I really prefer and recommend mineral-based sunscreens, which are sunscreens that contain the ingredients titanium dioxide and zinc oxide. That being said, some of the formulations of these products can be a little heavier weight or cast a little bit of a white sheen. So folks that have a little natural pigment to their skin may shy away from those and want to use more of the chemical blockers, which tend to have a little cleaner feel or a little more lighter feel, a little clearer going on, if that makes sense. And I think that there's been some concern about some of these ingredients being absorbed into the bloodstream. I think there's been concern about some of these ingredients damaging, you know, ocean life. And there's some, we talk about one of the ones in Europe that people really want over here is called Tinosorb. And, you know, that there's some initial research that might show that because that molecule is bigger than some of the ones we have over here, that there may be less absorption into the blood, for example. So it may help with some of those concerns that we have on some of the ones that are already available and give us more choices. So the more points I have to say, hey, if this one's not working for you, what about this one? I think the better off we're going to be.
Would you have any concerns about having European or Australian or Asian sunscreens being able to be bought and used here?
It happens every day already, Mark. I'll be honest. There are a lot of importers, and so that, you know, folks that are cosmetically savvy, and you know, some folks on, you know, that you see on Instagram and things like that are already bringing these things in. And I think that, you know, some of these that have been approved in Europe and Australia are both great examples of other developed nations, and you know, with big healthcare systems, for example, and good regulatory frameworks, where, you know, I think that we would be seeing some of these problems if the problems were going to be seen. So I think that we need to have a process to make sure these ingredients are safe, but I think that we've probably done ourselves a disservice by making it a bit too rigorous in this country. There's a lot of other things that we let come into this country as supplements and things like that with very little regulation at all, where I think there's probably a good middle ground here.
All right. Well, Josh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for the time, Mark. Appreciate it.
Dr. Josh Ternus is a board-certified dermatologist specializing in skin cancer surgery, laser surgery, and cosmetic dermatology with Banner Health. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. It is October, and at least for one Tucson artist, that means it's officially time for the Pink Eraser Arttober Challenge. Serena Rios McRae is the force behind the social media movement called Pink Eraser Art. She's created a community nearly 30,000 strong on Instagram and TikTok, where she documents, teaches, and curates Pink Eraser Art. What is that, you might be thinking? Well, it's actually pretty simple.
I love carving on erasers because it has made the art of carving so accessible that I can do it while I'm waiting in school pickup or while I'm waiting in the drive-thru, and I can take it with me everywhere I go.
That's Rios McRae in one of her very popular TikTok videos showing folks how to use a set of very simple tools to carve some really gorgeous drawings into those pink erasers. You might remember them from elementary school. You press them in ink and then stamp them. To Rios McRae, it's almost a meditation. And she told my co-host Lauren Gilger, it began for her out of a place of necessity.
It was a funny start because it was just a moment of like necessity. I was in a really stressful point in my life and was very financially strained, which was part of that stress. Mm-hmm. And I knew that if I made something with my hands consistently every day, that it would help me get through this period of time.
Yeah.
And so a friend of mine on Instagram, Naptime Press, she was like, I'm going to do Printtober, which was a challenge on Instagram. And she said, but I don't want to buy all the linoleum to do it for a whole month. So I'm just going to use a box of erasers. And I thought that was brilliant because I could afford a $12 box of erasers at the time.
Right.
And like, I was like, yeah, we can do that. And so her and another Instagram friend of ours, the three of us started carving erasers. And that was October 2023.
Yeah.
And by the third day, I was like obsessed. And like, it was immediately like connecting the brain and body and mental health and emotions that like I needed to process at the time.
Wow.
And like, the erasers are so soft mm-hmm. to carve into that it's just very soothing. So very quickly I was like, I'm not just doing this for a month. Like, I'm going to do this for eternity.
Tell me about how this took off so quickly. Like I wonder if you were surprised at how quickly other people caught on to this when you started sharing it on social media.
I created on day one a TikTok account and I called it Pink Eraser Art.
Yeah.
And I actually started it as a bit of an experiment because I was, the algorithm, sharing our artwork on social media is a whole beast.
Yes.
And so when I started my college degree, I started in psychology. And I find the way that like psychology, sociology, and the way that we interact online fascinating.
Yeah.
And so I was completely anonymous. I didn't share my face. I didn't share my voice. It was only my hands creating the artwork.
Right.
And by the fifth day that I posted, it had completely taken off. The biggest comment I remember getting was, how did you suddenly make printmaking not feel intimidating at all?
Right.
And that was like, everybody was commenting, like, I've always wanted to try this and it seems so scary, but like all of a sudden I'm watching you do this and I'm like, I can do that.
Yeah. Cause it's a pink eraser.
Right. Yeah.
That's amazing. So, I mean, you've got a book coming out on this and a lot of that kind of how to is in the book and design ideas, et cetera. How did that come about?
Oh, that was so fun. So I've always wanted to write a book. And my childhood dream was to write a novel. And I'm not surprised at all that my first book is a teaching like manual, because I've grown to love teaching. I've taught workshops for watercolor and all kinds of different mediums that I get my hands into. I love seeing sparks light up in other people.
Yeah.
And it's one of my favorite things in my life, especially when I have people come to a workshop who are so afraid to make a mark.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, I've had some people that they won't even put their brush to the paper until we're almost finished.
Right.
And then when they finally do, it's like something breaks open.
Wow.
And it's incredible to watch.
So I'm looking through the book here and there's a, you know, like a picture of the very minimal supplies you need for this. And one of them is a Band-Aid. I have to ask you what the Band-Aid's for.
Oh, the Band-Aid. So I have never cut myself with these tools, but it is probably the top comment that I get consistently. People are saying, you're carving too close to your fingers. That's so dangerous. Or I did that in high school and I cut my hands so much. And I've never cut myself. And I have a whole section in the book on safety so that you don't.
Yes.
You won't cut yourself. This is not a dangerous activity. People always laugh. When my dad first got to see the book, he opened it up and saw the Band-Aid and he said, you put a Band-Aid in here.
I'm glad I asked about it. Okay. So we're in the midst of what you've dubbed Pink Eraser Arttober. And this is like a challenge you do through your social media every October now, kind of like the way you got started, right, with Printtober. Has this caught on? Is this big? Lots of folks carving erasers because of you?
Across the entire world. And it's wow. Amazing. And I have a community account on Instagram that's called Pink Eraser Art. And I run it as a community page where people can collab their reels and their posts. And
cool.
So
yeah.
I want the whole thing to be a showcase of, you know, everybody who's doing this across the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been so cool watching people's skills grow over time. And then it's like a showcase
mm-hmm.
Of all the enthusiasts who just really love doing that. And I got an amazing post that somebody shared and she explained what the Pink Eraser Arttober was and that she was participating. And she said, I've made so many friends online. And like, this is so fulfilling and fun. And I'm like growing this community and meeting people. And
yeah.
It's just such a cool moment of feedback from somebody who's new, who I haven't gotten to know yet.
That's really great. So, mm-hmm. I mean, what's next for you, Serena? I wonder, like, are pink erasers it for the rest of your life? Are you going to expand this into other formats and other mediums as an artist?
Oh, you know, that's funny. Because so I have ADHD and I get my hands into every medium that catches my interest.
Hmm.
And over time, I find something new and I learn as much about it as I can before, you know, I see the next shiny thing and go on to learn something else. And over time, I've melded all of these materials and mediums together.
Yeah.
And so my art is constantly growing and changing. So like I started carving pink erasers and then last year I took a ceramic arts class for the first time. And within that class, I started stamping the erasers into clay.
Huh.
And so now that's a thing that I do.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And so my art is always growing and expanding because the ADHD brain craves novelty. So I've set up my life in such a way that I get to follow that.
All right. Well, congratulations on the book. That is Serena Rios McRae, a Tucson artist and author of the new book, Pink Eraser Art, The Ultimate Guide to Carving Incredible Eraser Stamps. Serena, thank you so much for coming on the show. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
With Halloween right around the corner, images of cemeteries are pretty much everywhere, from spooky movies to decorations. But Jennifer Schaefer Merry enjoys being in cemeteries year-round for the historical aspect of them. She's an archivist at the Arizona Historical Society and board member at the Pioneer Cemetery Association. She's also the chair of the Arizona chapter of the Association for Gravestone Studies. When I spoke with her back in 2023, we started with how she got into the field of studying gravesites.
Yeah, actually, so I've been a genealogist for most of my life, since I was in high school, and I started working on a cemetery in Ohio, actually, that my family was buried in, some ancestors, and I was really interested in some of the different aspects of why they were where they were and the religious affiliation of the cemeteries, and there's actually two of them a half a mile apart. And so once I started visiting and seeing the disrepair that the cemetery was in, I got really interested in how we work with cemeteries. And so I kind of had an interest in law, in who owned that cemetery and finding out what we could do to do some repair there. That never ended up happening, but it sort of led me to, while I live in Arizona, what can I do here? And it led me to our historic cemetery in downtown Phoenix, 14th Street in Jefferson.
What is the historical significance of cemeteries? Like, why is it important to a historian like yourself?
The cemeteries really give you an idea of who lived here in the past. So you can get a lot of historical information just from knowing that they're there, just from the location of where they're buried. So, for example, in our cemetery, we have a lot of early military figures. We've got a lot of early political figures. So just learning that they're there and who they were, we can find out a lot about early Phoenix and how Phoenix was settled. And then there's a lot of women and children that you may not know anything about other than their name and date that's on that cemetery. So you start doing more research into them.
What sorts of things does the field of gravestone studies focus on? Like, what do we hope to learn from this kind of work?
Yeah. So the main association that I belong to, the Association for Gravestone Studies, Pioneer Cemetery Association, also is a member. They started in the 60s, and early scholars were really focusing on, you know, Puritan sort of New England cemetery markers and more of the iconography. And that's a big part of the field, is the iconography and what you can learn from symbolism on the stones themselves. But there's also anthropology, archaeology, you know, the patterns of burials. You can study just the art itself. There's a lot of folks that are interested just in art. And we have you know, people that are interested in the spiritual and supernatural kind of things. You've got the ghost hunters and things like that that are interested in cemeteries. But it's really a lot of different. My interest is the preservation. I really like to do the hands-on work. I like to do making sure that these last so that other people can study them.
You mentioned the art. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously gravestones typically have the name and the date of birth, the date of death, maybe like a word or phrase about mm-hmm. them. But what kind of art tends to be involved here?
So obviously back east, like I said, the Puritans, there's a lot of meaning in the artwork on their stones, because you're talking about an illiterate population. So they told a story about that person, their beliefs, a lot of things. More modern or later 1800s, 1900s stones, especially here in Arizona, you get a lot of iconography that's either about mourning. So you've got flowers and things like that that represent religious beliefs or resurrection, things like that. Or you might have fraternal orders. That's a big one that we have. So there were thousands of different fraternal orders that people belong to, women and men. So you've got like your Masons, the IOOF, the International Order of Odd Fellows, different Woodmen of the World is another big one that we have. And all of these organizations had some kind of either insurance benefit for their members. So they would pay for them to be buried. And so most people wanted everyone in the afterlife to know, or everyone after they died to know that they were a member of this organization.
Is there ever controversy about what ends up on a gravestone?
Always. modern times, it seems to be – I like to read the news articles from all over about anything to do with cemeteries. I'm kind of weird like that. But there's a lot of stuff that you'll see about almost homeowners association kind of patrolling of cemeteries. You know, you don't want something too big that it overshadows somebody's plot next to them. I remember reading something about a SpongeBob SquarePants that someone had put for their deceased child.
Wow.
And it was too big, and it was an quote-unquote eyesore for the other folks around it. And so, yeah, there's always some kind of drama when it comes to either the size or the looks, or people put too many things on them. A lot of cultures have different sorts of meaning behind what they place on a grave marker. Some people don't like that. They think it looks trashy. You know, so yeah, there's all kinds of drama that you can get into. Lots of people have different beliefs on what a cemetery should be and where what they want to see when they come to see their deceased.
Does it seem as though there's a different sense of what should be on a gravestone in different communities, different cultures, different parts of the world, not just the art, but maybe the information, mm-hmm. the inscriptions on it, sort of describing the deceased?
Absolutely. Every culture has their own ways that they want to be remembered. So I think that there's all kinds of different things that you can see. And if you go through different specific religious cemeteries, you'll see a lot of different, you know, for example, in some of the Jewish cemeteries, you've got Hebrew inscriptions. Sometimes you've got pieces out of the Torah or the Torah. You've got different inscriptions for different religions, ethnic backgrounds, and everyone's got traditions. So they might put something different on their stone based on a tradition that was for their group.
What are some of the more interesting things that you have seen on gravestones during your time in cemeteries?
Oh, gosh. There's a lot of different carvings that are fascinating to me. And I really do love the different fraternal orders, because there's so many different ways that they show their symbolism. Some of the orders have thousands of different ways to show that they were a member of that particular group. There's a couple of the really big ones. And I usually tell people when I'm doing classes, if you see some kind of acronym that you don't know what it is, it's probably a fraternal order. It's probably nothing more than just figure out what that stands for, probably something in Latin, and figure out what group that belonged to.
What do you like about being in old cemeteries?
It's very peaceful. And the history of the Garden Cemetery in the United States is fascinating to me, because we went from burying your family in your backyard or on your farm or wherever to these great big, enormous, especially back east, ornately, you know, big trees, lush, actual boards of horticulturalists having something to do with the planning of the cemetery. You know, and I think that's making it just a real peaceful place to now, where we actually use them as places for recreation. So we have events in cemeteries, and that's not unusual.
Jennifer Schaefer-Merry is an archivist at the Arizona Historical Society and board member at the Pioneer Cemetery Association. We spoke back in 2023. And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday. That's it for this episode of the show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.